Swing into Seaside Golf in Ocean City, Maryland. Play like a pro at 17 championship courses designed by golf legends like Jack Nicklaus and Arthur Hills. Tee off on sweeping vistas at Eagle's Landing. Savor the coastal views of Lighthouse Sound. Or see why Ocean City Golf Club is considered one of the Mid-Atlantic's finest fairways. Whether you're sneaking in a quick round on a family vacation or going all in on a golf getaway, fun is always in play at Ocean City, Maryland. Plan your trip at OCOcean.com.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Ricky Henderson Podcast, the greatest of all podcasts, the GOAP. I'm your host, Alex Espinoza, with my co-host, Dr. Hot Dog, Hal Gordon. And we got a special guest, Vince Catronio, the longtime radio man for the A's. So glad to have Vince on here for episode 59. Vince, how you doing, man? You all right?
I'm doing great. I appreciate the invitation. Spring training, the weather's warmed up finally down here. I know it's been crazy in California, but this is spring training weather. Things are getting, to the point where you're starting to think about opening day. Cuts are being made. The roster's being pared down. Spring training's a little more manageable, so let's see what happens.
Yeah, I've been hearing you on the radio talking about the cold weather. You're a warm weather guy. Huh? You like it warm.
Very thin blood. I was born in New York. I left when I was a kid, grew up in Florida. Uh-huh. Only worked 1 year above the Mason-Dixon line, and that was in Des Moines, Iowa, back in 1988. I did not like it at all. I moved there in January of 1988, and people in Iowa, they live with it every day. I had no idea what these people were doing. So, for us in Phoenix, by our standards, I've lived down here. My wife and kids, we moved here from Dallas in 2008, and in that time, this by far has been the coldest winter we've had by Arizona standards, probably 15 degrees below normal. So, it finally got back to what it's normally like for a longer stretch of time. Hopefully that'll continue to the end until we break camp on the 25th.
Yeah. Since I grew up in Chicago. So, I was used to all the warm weather, after being here for like eight years. Now, whenever it dips, below 55 degrees, I'm just like, oh, it's so horrible. Why? So you lose that. You lose that cold. You lose that resistance to the cold weather real fast.
No doubt.
So Vince, I wanted to ask about growing up in Florida, where did you grow up in Florida? And there were no teams there. So who was your team? Who were you listening to? Who were your influences?
Well, that's a great question. I grew up in Orlando. My dad got transferred as a civilian working for the Navy from Long Island, New York, down to Orlando. So I moved down there in the mid-60s. And I was a Yankee fan just growing up, just because I was a part of a New York household. My dad was I'm Jets and Rangers and Jet and Yankees. My dad was Giants and Rangers and he was a Dodger fan, a Brooklyn Dodger fan, never forgave them for leaving. When he lived there, he watched Babe Ruth play when he was a kid. So coached all of his sons. I'm the youngest of four sons, coached them all in baseball. So the sport has always been very, very dear to us. And you're right. I didn't really, I listen to some guys that do what we do and so fortunate to do it. And they say, I grew up listening to Harry Carey or Jack Buck or, to take your pick, Vince Scully, of course, Bill King, John Miller. I didn't have those influences growing up. So I would, for us, the weekends were Atlanta Braves baseball before the Superstation. And it was on an independent station out of St. Petersburg. So we would go to the beach on Sundays and I'd come home. And it was WTOJ TD44. And I'd see, Buzz Capra and Dale Murphy and, all those kinds of players back in the day, Rick Mailer, and watch those games. And Milo Hamilton was doing the games with Ernie Johnson. And as it turns out, my first big league job was alongside Milo Hamilton. So it was pretty surreal how all that kind of came together. So I didn't really have an influence. I knew I wanted to do it as a kid. Thurman Munson was my favorite player. And I knew very early I was not going to be Thurman Munson. catcher, award number 15, the whole nine yards. First games we saw were the Yankees against the Royals. When we went back to New York for a funeral, as it turned out, one of my grandparents had passed away. My dad took us to Shea Stadium because the Yankee Stadium was under renovation in 74 and 75. Yeah, so we saw the Royals play. Roy White had four hits in the game. I remember that. And it was just a big deal. I mean, that was the first big league game I saw in person. Then we had spring training in Orlando with the Minnesota Twins, and I go to a couple of those games and see that, and then went to school at Central Florida when it was about as big as the room I'm sitting in. But they gave us, you know, we had a college radio station that you couldn't hear outside of this room, but we had a collection of people, whether it was news or sports or music, entertainment. We all took it so seriously. We had a great time, and I'm still close friends with many of those folks that were together back in the late 70s, early 80s. And that's where I got to learn play-by-play, doing baseball and basketball and football and hockey, or not hockey, but you know, some wrestling, some soccer, some volleyball, whatever it took, we put it on the air and just made all of our mistakes, cut our teeth, got an internship at NBC in New York. Out of that, just simply on a whim, you know, with a phone call. I always tell students when I talk to them that are on the verge of making decisions about internships, say always start at the top. Let them tell you no and work your way down the list. And that's what I did. I was lucky that my first call was a yes. And I don't know why it happened, but it did. I was supposed to be with Marv Albert. He was my idol growing up, because when we went back for that funeral back in 74, my cousin Vito, who still lives in the same apartment from 1974, he's one year older than me, you know, in Brooklyn. And they would watch the Knicks on television, turn down the sound and turn on Marv Albert on radio when he was doing it back in the heyday, when Marv was the voice of the Rangers and the Knicks on radio. And I was just enthralled with that they felt so strongly about an identification with this person. And they wanted this person to deliver, you know, what they're about to watch. So that's kind of how it all got started. And I went to New York. It didn't work out with Marv because it was the summer of 81. It was the strike of 81 with the baseball strike. So I went to the radio side, which turned out to be okay. I worked with a gentleman named Mark Mason, who basically was part of the group that founded WFAN in New York, not too far after that, and got some great experience, made some great contacts, got to go to the Olympics because of that, with some of those NBC people in Seoul, Korea in 1988. And just, you know, I was very lucky from a guy that didn't know much, didn't have that influence growing up that I could listen to and rely on, to where I got a chance to get a jump on what's been a, you know, a very thankful and satisfying career so far.
Well, how's a Chicago guy? Like the Iowa Cubs, they're like a big deal over there, right? Like it's like a fun franchise, right? And I saw you were minor league broadcaster of the year over there. Was that kind of like a big year for you? 88, you said you went to the Olympics as well. Was that a kind of breakthrough for your career? Yeah.
It just kind of came out of nowhere. It was the first ever they created this award. I went to the National Baseball meetings in Atlanta. I accepted the award at one of the big luncheons that they had. And from that, I went to the Olympics. I was a finalist for a New York Mets job, which Gary Cohen got. And I knew Gary that year. He was in Pawtucket. I was in Iowa. Joe Buck was in Louisville. I was in Iowa. I don't know whatever happened to Joe. I don't know if he ever went on to do anything.
Yeah. I haven't heard from him since. Yeah.
Because Gary was already.
I heard he was working for his dad or something. But
yeah. He was, you know, you know, Gary was already filling in for Bob Murphy on Mets radio. Yeah. And so I told him, he goes, man, you just got this award. You're going to the Olympics. I go, dude, unless you're axe murdering somebody between now and opening day, the job is yours. But it was a great experience to fly to New York, to go through the interview process, to actually try to attempt to do a game off of a television monitor. That was part of their process. It was just a very, very unique experience. And from there, I moved down to Tucson. Spent 2 years in Tucson with the Astros AAA club. That's where I met my wife, Veronica, who's in Tucson as we speak, with her sisters. We've been married 31 years now, three healthy, wonderful kids. So it's worked out pretty well.
Yeah, and do you remember the first time you met Ken? Because it was during that Tucson stint that I was reading on your Wikipedia page. Is that right? Is that where you met Ken? Because he was with Las Vegas. Is that right?
I'm glad somebody's reading this page, because I certainly don't. But yeah, because he was in Vegas and I was in Tucson. Yeah. So we certainly knew each other. You know, Rich Waltz was his partner back then as well, who's actually doing something at WBC this year on Fox. So yeah, that's where I first met Ken and started a little bit of that relationship, which I tell people all the time. You just don't know at what point in your life that relationship is going to come back and lift you up and maybe give you an opportunity that you didn't necessarily see coming. And with the passing of Bill, you know, we had known each other at that point. Then after that 91, I went to the Astros. He began did some filling with the Orioles, and he went on to Oakland, and I was still in Houston, and then went on to Texas, saw each other then, saw his daughter, Emily, who's now 30 years old. I saw her when she was like 3 years old. So and his wife, Denise. So it was a long relationship, a long friendship. And I was out of baseball for 2 years. And when Bill passed away, several folks from the A's had contacted me and said, you're somebody we're really interested in. And I told Ken, I said, look, I'm going to apply for the job. I'm not asking for you to endorse me in any way, shape, or form. It's a tough position to be in for you because you're getting inundated from former partners and guys that you know, like myself in the business. I'm just letting you know that it's there. And through the process, our familiarity, his familiarity with my work ethic, and it just kind of all came together. And fortunately, you know, it's going to be my 18th year with Ken, and couldn't be more thankful. It's been a great partnership. I've learned a lot from Ken. You know, he's got the voice of God. That's something I don't have, but I make the most of my situation. And we both had some great moments along the years. It's a little lean right now, but we've had some great memories together in that booth. And, you know, when I first got to Oakland, my first broadcast in spring training, because Bill had passed away in October, never got a chance to say goodbye. Fans never got a chance to say goodbye to him. And I went on the air. I said, look, I'm not Bill King. I will never pretend to be Bill King. I'm going to be Vince. Hopefully over time, I know this is very difficult for you, and there is a voice that's lacking in your life. And I've been asked to step in on a small basis and fill in some of those blanks. Just please be patient. Hopefully as you're going out to get a gallon of milk, you'll hear the score more than once. And as time goes on, you'll begin to hopefully enjoy the stories, enjoy my play-by-play. Just enjoy my personality, my togetherness with Ken, and we can hopefully build a partnership. And it took time, as it should, because with Bill, who's one of the greatest of all time, not only in baseball but in so many sports, and you're the person that's stepping into that booth, not in his chair, but into his booth. Yeah. You just have to be. I mean, I was very respectful of what I was doing, and very thankful that I swore when I got in this business, no offense to California, but I couldn't live full time in California, especially with a wife and three young kids at the time. I said I would never work for a California team. I worked for a California team longer than anybody else, and I'm so thankful that this opportunity has presented itself. So many thanks to the East Bay fans, Oakland fans, and the Oakland community.
I want to ask a question. You said that Ken knew what your work ethic was like. And, you know, for people who are not in broadcasting, for people who just, you know, turn the radio on or now turn the app on, like I do when they're on the road, turn the app on when I'm like on a run and just listen to you guys, tell me about the game. It seems like a job that you just sort of show up for. You say, you know, you call the game and you go home. But like what more, tell us, what more does it take to be able to do that?
Well, the most important thing in the game is to follow the ball, because you're listening to the game. You want to know what's happening on the field. That said, you have to be prepared for almost any type of circumstance. And even though the game starts at 6:40, typically my day starts with preparation no later than 8:00 in the morning. Now, it's not all day, but there are books that I keep up on a daily basis. There are notes that I keep in another book that I update periodically, and I update the league every day. And then you start reading stories and you jot notes down, and you have stuff ready to use if necessary. If it's especially now at the pitch clock, who knows if we'll get a chance to get much of this in. But if it's a 2-1 game or a 3-1 game, as Milo used to tell me all the time, these are the games we do for free. But we have a game down. Like when young broadcasters send me some of their work, I always tell them, don't send me your highlights. I don't need your greatest hits. And listen to my home run call. Here's my double play call. Here's my play at the plate. I need in the fourth inning where you've lost 7 in a row and you're down 8-1. How are you going to entertain me? How are you going to keep me listening? And that's the challenge that you have. And that's what you have to be prepared for. There's certainly with the analytic model now, with so much involved, and the opportunity for fans to have access almost as to as much information as I do.
Yeah.
But the one thing they don't have is access to the clubhouse. They don't have access to scouts. They don't have access to David Forst or other baseball executives that I've known over the years. I mean, Perry Manassian, who is the GM of the Angels, was a bat boy when I was with the Texas Rangers from 98 to 03. And he comes to the booth and we're like old friends and people are looking around like, how do you get the GM to walk into your booth? Well, that relationship began when, you know, he was just a kid with the Manassian family, which includes Zach, who works for the Giants, Calvin, who works for the Nationals. You know, they're it's just, it's intertwined. And so that helps. I mean, I'm trying to get information, trying to get stories. And especially if you're listening and something happened last night that we don't have the answer to during that game, you're relying on me to ask Tony Kemp what happened on that play, or talk to James Kaprielian and say, tell me about that pitch sequence, help you get out Yordan Alvarez. Why did you decide to go the way you did? And that's something that they can't get on their computer at FanGraphs or Baseball Savant or, you know, Baseball Prospectus. Take your pick. There's a thousand of them out there, all very good and all very helpful to me as well. So that's the one thing I have. I've always had a great relationship with scouts. I'm 62 years old. I've been in the game 40 years, including my time in the minor leagues. And I am still learning every day. And I don't, in no way, shape, or form do I know this game, like, you know, frontwards or backwards. There's stuff that's happening out there that I ask questions about. And I'm thankful that these guys are able to use their eyes and their perspective and help me sound better on the air. Plus, when we've had Shooty on the air, or when we had Coco Crisp on the air, or when I talk to ex-players that are doing the game, if I've done a couple of games with Dallas on television or whatever, so look, I never stood in the box. I've never been in the clubhouse, you know, during the quiet times. I've never been on the mound. Now, I can call the fly ball to center field, and you can help tell me what the pitcher, batter, whatever that situation, what that player might be thinking. You know, what is going through their mind? How are they going to handle that situation? And that's the respect I have. Plus, it's a really hard game. Yeah. I mean, I know fans get mad. How come he couldn't hit that 97-mile-an-hour fastball? Yeah. You know, like a snake going to the plate. Why couldn't he hit it to the opposite field? They got the shift on. Why didn't he just hit it the other way? Why didn't he run more? Well, yeah. It's, you know, like for an example, Tyler Wade, who may or may not make the club. He's a non-roster invitee. Yeah. Wherever Tyler Wade grew up, which was in Temecula, down in Southern California, at that time, Tyler Wade was the best player in Temecula, okay? He was the best player. And then that funnel, you know, gets smaller and smaller as you move up through the ranks. So there's a bunch of Tyler Wades that were the best in their place. And then how do you handle that? How do you rise above it? How do you become the player that breaks through and scratches out the kind of career that Tyler's had, let alone if you're a superstar like Jose Altuve or Alex Bregman, or oncoming superstar like Julio Rodriguez, you know, take your pick of different players. It's a really hard game, and you have to be respectful of that. You have to be truthful. You're making mistakes out there, doing some things that don't make sense. You have to be truthful, and they want you to be truthful. Mm-hmm. And they don't want you to sugarcoat it, but you don't have to go overboard on certain things. And try to do something to appease the fan base, because you have to respect A, of how hard the game is, and respect that you're in the clubhouse the next day. And you're there to, if somebody has something to say to you, you have to be there to answer.
Well, I've noticed that you pretty much throughout BP, you're just constantly talking to people, players, other broadcasters, visiting people. Like, you're just constantly gathering information, right? Like, that's part of the deal too, right?
That's what we do. I mean, it's just trying to, sometimes you're going to get nuggets that you go, wow, I can't believe that this landed in my lap. It's a great story about this guy, because this happened 5 years ago when he was in a cab or whatever, and now he's at this spot. And it gives you an opportunity to tell that story and present that to the fans. Again, the access that we have is important, but we're all exchanging information. The broadcasters are very close fraternity. We're a very helpful fraternity among ourselves, because we know how hard the job is. And, you know, we want to present the product as best we can. And that is part of it. But before the game, there'll be scouts that will come into the booth and I'll fire questions at them all the time about players or situations or something. I'll go to the umpires room. My first year, 2006, right, with Ken. So I said, I'll be back in a little bit. I'm going to go down the umpires room. And we all know Bill King's relationship with umpires.
Yes.
So Ken looks at me and goes, what do you mean? And I said, I'm going to ask Bill Miller about what happened on that play last night. I need a further explanation on why it was called the way it was.
Yeah.
Was it running or whatever? He goes, well, we don't do that here. I go, well, I've been doing it for years. I mean, if you have a question, don't you want to ask that person the question? So going down the umpire's room is just part of the process. It doesn't happen a lot, but it happens some. And the umpires are thankful. They're appreciative that you're down there, that you want to know what's happening. You want to ask them, you know, because they've got a hard job as well, too, especially with every camera angle known to man and super slow motion and guys' fingernails off the, you know, off the base. They got to call them out and ridiculous stuff like that. But it just strengthens. I think it strengthens the broadcast and just makes it better because I can go down and do that. I mean, there are people that are in the game that were with, like, my first team in 1984, my first full-time team with the Lynchburg Mets, that are still in the game. Mike Cubbage was my manager. He was a longtime scout for the Nationals and some other teams I had seen around the league. Dan Plesac was on it. MLB Network. We were together in 1985 when I was in El Paso. He's one of our pitchers. We're still good friends to this day. And then, like I mentioned, Perry Manassi and Scott Service, who's the manager of the Mariners. So we were together first at the Olympics in 88, got drafted by the Astros. I had him in Tucson. I was in the big leagues when I got called up at the All-Star break of 1991. Our wives are best friends. Scott and Jill are godparents to one of my kids. So that relationship is one that I lean on as well. So I'm just very thankful. There are a lot of people in the game that I've seen and thankful to call friends and thankful that they're willing to help give us some information.
Yeah. And you mentioned the fraternity. I always thought, like, the A's radio fraternity is pretty amazing. Like, over the decades, you know, Monty Moore, Lon Simmons, Bill King, Ray Fosse, you know, Ken Korak and you, I mean, what's it like to be part of that group? Just, you know, so many greats over, you know, generations. You know?
Well, it's humbling, obviously. I love Monty to death. I wish I saw more of him. I wish I could see more of him at the ballpark. Still has tremendous energy and tremendous love for the Astros and or for the A's, right, and all the, you know, all the people that you mentioned along the way. It is, you know, it is a booth that, you know, that has a lot of history and thankful, because listening to games from the A's perspective, much like the clubhouse, it's different. You're not going to hear this kind of broadcast in Chicago or St. Louis or Atlanta or even Baltimore. It's a unique vibe that we're able to use from the clubhouse and use from the history that's inside that booth and bring that out. I think fans appreciate that. Fans appreciate that we don't root. They know that I work for the A's. I don't root on the air. They'll tell by my voice if the A's are winning or losing, and I think that's good enough. I'll certainly provide the excitement when those opportunities present itself, like Hamilton drops the ball or, you know, yeah, things of that nature. Brandon Moss, Grand Slam, walk-off capital of baseball, that kind of stuff. I mean, that's there and it's genuine. But when the A's make a bad play or when the opposing team makes good plays, you acknowledge that. You tip your cap to that, because that's part of recognizing just good, clean baseball.
Yeah, for sure. And what's it – I mean, it must be kind of surreal for you to see. I mean, a couple of years ago, I had Dom on here. I think it was episode 17. I had him on the podcast. And I mean, yeah, he's doing radio stuff with the Brewers right now. Is that right? And
correct.
I mean, how cool. I mean, you guys were calling games together a couple of springs ago. That must have been amazing. I mean, what's it like, you know, seeing him kind of go, you know, follow in your footsteps like that and get into the field like that?
Well, I mean, you're going to get me to cry, but then you put on your father, you know, your dad cap. Yeah. And you always want.
We want that content for YouTube. So go ahead.
both eyes. Both.
As a father, you want your kids to exceed your own dreams. And my dad fought in World War II. Didn't even graduate high school. He was, you know, he was in Germany and Italy and Luxembourg as a 19, 20 year old. And seeing all four of his kids, all four of his boys, go to college and go on to things. I know was very humbling to him and my mom. And we feel the same way. Veronica and I feel the same way. We want nothing but the best for our kids. We want them to, you know, surpass, you know, the life we've been able to give them to this point. Dominic's an incredibly talented kid. I mean, he's a kid that, Alex, you can speak to this. I mean, the stuff that you guys know now with shout out to Cronkite, but stuff that he can do with video and with building podcasts and, you know, statistical research and just having a love for the game. When we've done those games in spring training, it was a joy. It was a great joy. I mean, how could it not be to sit along your side your son and do some baseball games? It was a dream we all always had. I mean, Dominic was on a baseball field when he was 5 years old. Yeah. You know, when we were in Texas, when they let the kids on the field prior to batting practice to take ground balls, he was taking ground balls with Patrick Mahomes. He was taking ground balls with Derek Rodriguez. He was taking ground balls with, you know, Preston and Patrick Palmeiro. I mean, these are kids that were part of the team back in, you know, 02 when, you know, Dominic was 8 years old. He's out shagging in 2003 out in center field during batting practice. They finally let him go out there. Like his last game, he finally caught a ball out in center field. And Francisco Cordero's looking up to the booth. He's trying to get my attention. Hey, your son caught one. It's great. I mean, he's been around it forever. He's very comfortable around it. Mm-hmm. He's really good at what he does. He's really talented. I'm hopeful that he gets a play-by-play opportunity. He's come close a couple of times at the major league level. In the meantime, he's excelled at everything they put in front of him. He does pre and post stuff for the Brewers. He does their weekly show during spring training. He does some podcasts for them. He works for Brian Anderson on television, on the Valley Games for research. He goes with Brian during the season for TBS for their game of the week. He does the playoffs. He worked with Bob Costas the last 2 years. That's amazing. Impressed with his work. So the kid goes in everything he does with the idea to be the very best he can be. And he's still a really good golfer. So he still loves the game. He goes, I'm a nerd. I mean, he loves the golfing part of it. He loves the baseball part of it. He loves being around it. He's very comfortable in a clubhouse. And hopefully, like I was explaining before with me and Ken, there's going to be somebody that's been in his life that we don't even know yet that's going to be influential in him getting that opportunity. And when he does, he'll run with it and he'll gather a lot of steam and he'll be recognized in a really short period of time.
Yeah, absolutely. But
I appreciate you, you know, asking a dad about a son. Now, I got two daughters as well, by the way. Just I got to be clear, I'm a girl. The daughters are doing great. My oldest, Olivia, is married. Her husband, Troy, they're doing great. And my youngest, Sophia, is here at home, and she's a budding anime artist. She's really good at that, too. So I'm trying to get her together with Shintaro Fujinami at some point because Studio Ghibli. My daughter's been to the Studio Ghibli Museum in Japan. She went with me on the Japan trip, the last one the A's were on in 18 or 19. So I would love for them to meet you. She's actually taking some Japanese courses. It's fun just for them to converse for 30 seconds.
That'd be amazing. Those films are amazing. I really like the Studio Ghibli stuff. It's pretty wild. Yeah,
awesome. There's some great stories that are told in those films for sure.
Well, spring training must be great for you. Your whole family's there, right? I mean, you're just at home, like, and everybody's around. That must be a great part of the year for you, then. Right?
It is. I mean, Dom's home makes mom happy. That's the most important thing, you know, because Dom's the only one that doesn't live in the state anymore. Lives in Milwaukee, but. Mm-hmm. He got a chance to come down here full time for spring training. Obviously, he has a place to stay. He's got cars here that he can use. We kind of all juggle each other's day to make sure somebody has a car, you know, to go where they need to go. Or I'm going to spring training, and Sophia's going to work, and Veronica's got to go do something, and you know, Dominic's got to go as well. So we've made it work. It's been fun. Very thankful for sure.
That's awesome.
So speaking about spring training, we had some cuts today.
We did.
Let's talk a little bit more about the roster. So, you know, unfortunately, sadly, my spring training crush, Lawrence Butler, got sent down. But I think we kind of all knew that was going to
happen. Yeah, that was coming.
I don't think he left on a bad note either. I mean, we know who Lawrence Butler is now for sure.
Yeah.
And sure, he's definitely on the fast track. And that's the fun part of spring training.
Yeah.
Is to see a young player who is a legitimate prospect. Okay, let's be clear about that. And, you know, everybody talks about, you know, how barren maybe the A's system is. Well, we've seen him. We've seen Denzel Clark, who's now with Team Canada, Jordan Diaz with Team Colombia. And we've seen those guys make you know, make impacts. But, you know, Lawrence will be paid attention to at AA. He may be on the fast track. Who knows? Zach Geloff, of course, with Team Israel as well. So, to me, seeing J.J. Bleday sent down, you know, this kid was the fourth overall pick by the Marlins not too long ago out of Vanderbilt.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the thing. You take a flyer on somebody like that. You know, A.J. Puck was the sixth overall pick when the A's got him out of Florida. And those organizations look at that and say, well, we can do something with him. Now, A.J. began to establish himself as a good late reliever last year.
Yeah.
Now, J.J. hasn't done that yet. And the outfield competition has been interesting to see unfold. I will say this. We all know the 2022 spring training was unlike anything any of us had experience with. All these, you know, first it was Chris Bassett, and then it was Matt Olson, then it was Matt Chapman, then it was Sherman, all leaving in, you know, a span of like 10 days, and all these hugs in the clubhouse and a lot of tears in the clubhouse, and all these new players. I don't even think the trade had taken place yet for Shea Langeliers. I don't even think he's been in the organization a year as we speak. I mean, that's how recent all this stuff happened. Yeah. So, you know, trying to see these guys come in on the fly, trying to get into the organization. They had tough years in the organization, but I think this year will be a much more settling year, and hopefully we'll see some progress at a lot of those young players. But for me, I mean, seeing J.J. Bleday sent down is something that kind of, I wouldn't say surprising, but because there's competition out there, somebody has to go, and he has options, and we know Christian Pache does it, and Pache had two more hits today, including a triple against the Giants. So he's been fun to watch. He knows what's at stake. And he's a talented kid. He's the best defender by far. He's better than Ruiz in center field. But they love Ruiz, so they acquired in that three-team deal. And we'll see how that plays out.
Yeah, Ruiz had a really good catch today, too. And
but he kind of took like a circuitous route. He ended up with the dive. But he's got great tools.
Yeah,
he hasn't played center field a whole lot. Now, center field is like in the back pocket for Pache. He's already made three unbelievable plays.
Pache's amazing.
During spring training. So.
Yeah, and what do you like Ryan Nota's chances to make the squad? I mean, he keeps on producing. I think he had a double either today or yesterday. I think it was today. He had another double, and you know, he's a Rule 5 guy. He started out hot, and he's keeping it up. And they optioned Dermis Garcia today, and you know, like you said, Bleday. So those two more guys who were fighting for spots.
Right. I think Nota does have an excellent chance. I mean, look, this is a team that lost 102 games last year. You can take a Rule 5 guy, and let's be honest. And Nota's, you know, a little more experienced, a little older. He's shown power in the Dodgers system. He's a better defender than Jesus Aguilar. You know, Jesus has been, by far, Jesus has been the best guy to talk to in camp.
Oh, is he a fun guy?
Yeah.
He accepts the leadership role. I mean, I'm hoping that there's going to be some semblance of the all-star Aguilar that plays for the A's, because that will really be fun to watch, and it'll be – you know, a great get for the Athletics. He can do a whole lot of things inside that clubhouse. Nota, I think, is going to get a chance, especially because he bats left-handed. So, and with Jesus batting right-handed. So you're going to see those platoons. To me, the wild card is Seth Brown.
Really?
Seth hasn't played a whole lot successfully against left-handed pitching. That's something he wants to be more of a regular player, more of an everyday player. I see him in left field right now. He played a lot of first base last year. I don't think you need him at first base, but if Nota doesn't make the club, then you're doing that. You know, if you've got Brown in left, you've got Pache or Ruiz in center, Laureano in right. That would be against the right-handed pitcher, and then against the left-handed pitcher, you would go. You know, then you've got Pache, Ruiz, Laureano probably in the outfield. Against the left-hander. And see where that takes you.
So you have that access to the clubhouse. I'm wondering, how do you think Mr. Fuji is fitting in? You know, I see him on the Tiny Mike interviews, and he's got a lot of English words, but I know it can be just really tough for players who you know, Japanese is such a different language, just showing up, and you know, it's not like the Latino players who have a bunch of other people that they can, you know, can talk
right
to and hang out. Yeah.
I will say this. My impression is that when we get to opening day and people look at the American League West, certainly the Astros are the class of the division. I get that. Jacob DeGrom and all the money that the Rangers spent. you know, Mariners getting to the postseason for the first time since 2001, and will the Angels keep Shohei Ohtani, and will they get to the playoffs, where that's going to happen. For me, Shohei Ohtani is the big story because everybody can be talking about every day, and right behind him is Fujinami. And those guys have been tied together since 2012.
Yeah,
he has been fun to see interact in the clubhouse. He wants to be one of the guys, you know, through Issei, his interpreter, who also, by the way, is a strength coach. So not your normal interpreter who, you know, knows the language on both sides of the Pacific Ocean. But this guy has a little more, you know, in his game than just that. So I'm sure he's been involved in part of Fuji's team with the things that he does.
Nice. Getting
ready for a game. So here's what I think about Fuji. This is a guy that I think if you could drill down and really ask him, he feels like he should have been here years ago in the United States. He wanted to be posted years ago. He wanted to be on the Ohtani track. And when that didn't happen, I think you can make the case that he went, you know, that it got in his head. And you could see those numbers go sideways. He had trouble with control, couldn't find the strike zone, spent some time back and forth, Japanese big leagues, and then down Japanese minor leagues, back and forth, including last year. But I think last year he finally turned the corner at the end. I think this is where – I think he wants this moment. I think he wants this opportunity to shine. He's got the stuff. Certainly control has been an issue in the past. But when you throw 99 and he's got this devastating split-fingered fastball to go with the slider and the curveball, I think he will be so much fun to watch. If you can get 140 to 150 innings from Fujinami, for me, that is major success and major value. Plus, remember, in order to get him to come to the United States, he's not under control of the A's. This is it. It's a one-year deal. So he's the guy that's going to be gathering a lot of attention. He's pitching for himself. He's pitching for a bigger contract in the big leagues, using the A's as a possible springboard. The A's are certainly a team that would say, look, if you're pitching well, hey, don't forget us. We're the ones that brought you here. So let's figure out a way to keep you, even if it means on a shorter deal, at least at first, with you know, a bump up in your salary from past $3 million. That would be interesting to see. But I really do believe that Fujinami thinks that his time is overdue. He's ready to accept the challenge. And I think it's going to be a lot of fun to watch.
Well, it's interesting that you say that, you know, the A's might try and bump up a salary or sign him again. I kind of figured, oh, well, if this guy's any good and the A's are as bad as we think that they, you know, they might be, then, you know, this is sort of a win-win for the A's where, oh, you know, well, we at least spent some money for, you know, so they don't complain as much about the revenue sharing. And maybe we can trade him at the trade deadline if he's any good. But I mean, that'd be really cool. He seems like a really personable guy. I really hope we get to hear more from him.
Well, it's a fair point. I mean, there's no question that if he's pitching well, that there's going to be conversations about him around the trade deadline, and how the A's handle that remains to be seen. And I'm hopeful that he pitches the opening weekend against the Angels. Yeah. I think it's pretty.
That'd be fun.
Pretty much a done deal that you're going to see Paul Blackburn at opening night against Shohei on Thursday, off on Friday. Then you got the Saturday and the Sunday. I'm hopeful that he's in one of those games in the rotation. I mean, how could he not be? You're trying to create buzz. You're trying to create excitement as best you can, and that's one way to do it.
From my perspective of the person in the seats with the fans, you know, those Shohei days are something special, and I'm really hoping. I think it'd be really great too if the Japanese fans are in town for Shohei's opening day, you know, if they stick around for Fuji, you know, I've said this before on this season of this podcast, the Japanese fans are, first of all, they're just a delight to interact with. And
the important question is, do they buy hot dogs?
So they do buy hot dogs. I will say, Japanese fans, if you're listening, I feel like the tipping custom in Japan is less strong than
it is in the United States. The truth comes out.
How do you design a hot dog, an American hot dog, for a Japanese fan? Do you have anything special that you could give them that gives them a little bit of a Japanese flavor?
Oh, I think, you know, I think that they really love, you know, I think in Japan they really like pickled stuff. So that sauerkraut. That sauerkraut is always a big
get some
with
seaweed
them.
Wrap. Wrap that thing in seaweed.
You know, that's why, yeah. You know what? Honestly, that's why I'm not getting. That's why I'm not getting the tips. I need to have like shrimp chips to put on top of it.
Well, Vince, do you think it's possible they go to? I mean, Kotze has talked about the possibility of a 6-man rotation or something like kind of like, you know, a normal 5 days, but then Fuji every Tuesday or something like that, you know, like a once a week Fuji, something like, do you think that's a possibility?
Yeah. I think it's a real possibility, and they'll try to figure it out. It's almost like a hybrid or 5.5 man or 6 man.
Yeah.
They'll take advantage of the off days. Guys will get extra time off and have to adjust to that kind of schedule. We know pitchers are very much creatures of habit. You know, they've got certain throw days, certain rest days, certain lift days to get them strong for their next start. I think they're all on board with that. And it will be an adjustment. It will not be a straight up 5-man rotation with Fuji in there. It'll take some balance. It'll take some work. It'll take, you know, some time where he's going to be between starts. And that's why I think if you can get to 140 or 150 innings, I would be really happy with that in his first major league season.
All right. Yeah. So I want to ask you, I want to bring you in on something that Alex and I have done. So Alex and I think on our first episode, we went through, this was before spring training even started. We picked 9 players, each of the A's, and we're going to see at the end of the season, which team has the most WAR. And so I think you,
how's the stat guy?
You know a lot more than us. So I'm going to give you the two teams, and I want to hear who you would have picked, you know, whose team you like better. Okay, so team one is Ramon, Paul Blackburn, Amadi Diaz, Kaprielian, Ken Waldichuk, Jace Peterson, Drew Ushinsky, Domingo Acevedo, and Danny Jimenez. Okay. All right, and then group team two is Seth Brown, Tony Kemp, Shane Langeliers, Fuji, Jesus Aguilar, Pache, Trevor May, Zach Jackson, and Nick Allen.
I think it's the first one.
Yeah, let's go.
I mean, you're asking me right off the cuff to pick one.
Start it.
I still think Pache will struggle.
Oh, yeah.
Nick Allen still has a ways to go offensively.
Oh, yeah.
But Ledesma's Diaz is going to be pretty important piece to this A's team.
Yeah, when he's healthy, he's a great bat. Yeah.
Or plays second base and even some third base. I think that's an important piece for the A's. So Tony Kemp is Tony Kemp. I mean, yeah. I love him. And of course, having Fuji and Seth Brown leading the club at home runs last year, it's not a bad way to go. And if you got Langeliers too in that second team, I mean, he's got a chance to lead the team in hitting. He's got a chance to hit. I think he's got a chance at 20 plus and maybe drive in 80. So that says an awful lot for a kid really in his first full season in the big leagues. He can hit. I mean, he can catch. I mean, he's the real deal. The A's really hit on getting him for Matt Olson. So
yeah.
I think another two names that are still in big league camp that are intriguing to me are Esturi Ruiz and Kevin Smith. You know, I feel like Kevin, if he wasn't doing that well, he would have been probably cut down, but he's kind of keeping himself in right now. And, you know, I know Jace Peterson, they signed him. He's here for the next couple of years. That might complicate things, but what do you think about those two guys? I know they both have options, but what do you think? Do you think they're going to be kind of those bubble guys at the end of
well,
camp?
Well, Ruiz will break camp with the club. I mean, he'll come north for the Giants series. Whether or not he makes the club, we'll know certainly at that point. Kevin Smith is a real intriguing story because it was a frustrating year. And I go back to a guy that was a Toronto Blue Jay, you know, in Dunedin, and suddenly he's flipped. He's with the new organization trying to learn everybody. It was a condensed spring training. Everything was happening so fast. And he got off to such a slow start offensively, except for the series in Toronto. Still catch the ball. He's a decent defender. And then he goes down to Las Vegas and the same thing. I mean, he was struggling mightily until he got to, you know, late August and into September, where he hit 11 home runs in September. And as Mark Kotze said, we could have called him up for September, but maybe it was better off to keep him down there. He says he's in the best frame of mind in any camp he's ever been in. The jury is still out. They think he's made some adjustments to a swing path, which can help him make better contact. So You know, we'll see. I mean, yeah. Kevin Smith may last a little bit longer, but you've got Diaz and you've got Jace Peterson, and even in a pinch, you've got Tony Kemp at third base. So, I mean, Kevin Smith has a chance to make the club if he does, as a utility guy, because he could play second, short, and third, and you've got a right-handed power there, but that's what Diaz is. So we'll see. He's a kid you root for. I mean, he was MVP at Triple-A with his Buffalo team 2 years ago. There's some success in there. Trying to get it to translate to the big leagues is always the $64,000 question.
For sure. And just a couple more. Like the past couple of days, the pitching's been really strong. I think Aller had 7 strikeouts yesterday. JP Sears had 6 today. Caprillion had 5 today. That's still, I mean, I know Adrian Martinez was just optioned, so he's kind of out of the mix now, but there's still about 9 guys. I'd probably still consider Freddie Tarnock. Is he still in the mix? Like, how do you see the rotation competition kind of shaking out right now?
Well, that's the great thing. There's some legitimate competition. I mean, JP threw the ball much better today, went 5 innings.
Yeah.
I'm certainly when you look at Adam Aller's line, it's successful. Yeah. I get that.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's always had confidence issues. He's always had great stuff. He faced, you know, a lineup where basically there was nobody in it. I mean, just got to be honest. I mean, he faced a bunch of, you know, minor league guys, and he did what he was supposed to do. Uh-huh. Now, if he faces a different lineup he'll have that opportunity. He'll face a lineup later on, whatever the team is, where there'll be more of a major league lineup where 6 or 7 regulars will be playing. How he performs in that game will be, for me, a better indicator of where he is. I like his stuff. I like his chances, but I would temper that. I mean, Caprillion getting into a game today, going in and 2/3 is huge. I think James Caprillion 2 years ago would be really worried about where he is. I don't think he's worried where he is if you think he's behind.
Right.
I think the A's can push him to the back of the rotation, give him even a little more time to get ready for the season. You know, maybe pitch at the end pitch in the Giants series and give him even more time off, which will allow him to be ready for his spot in the rotation. Sears, Walter, you know, don't forget Kyle Muller, who came, big lefty who came over from Atlanta. He's got good stuff. Hasn't really consistently commanded his breaking ball. I like Tarnock. He's a laid back dude. Comes at you at 95 with a good changeup and a good breaking ball. Martinez is still in the mix, as Morcotte said. We had to option him out because of the WBC. He needs to get innings back in the minor league camp. He may be on the outside looking in. I think that's the way it looks right now. But if you're asking me, it's Blackburn, Fuji, Cap, Rosinski, and then you're fighting between Sears, Waldichuk, Muller, and Aller. And I think at least one of those guys will be, if not in the starting rotation, there'll be a swing guy that'll be asked to give multiple innings in a game to back up somebody, whether it's Fuji or somebody else at the beginning of the season. So while this is a team that only won 60 games last year, and there are prognosticators that are saying even less than that this year, I would disagree with that. If the tumblers all kind of click together, I mean, I see this team closer to 70 wins. Again, have to stay healthy. Fuji has to be doing what he's doing. Paul Blackburn has to come back. Aguilar has to come back to what he'd done in the past. You know, things like that have to maintain itself over the long season. Ramon Laureano's got to come back. Nick Allen's got to improve offensively. There are a lot of ifs in that statement to get to 70 wins. But last year, they were so overmatched. Now, they battled to the 27th out every single night. I give them credit for that.
Oh, man.
But there wasn't a whole lot of firepower there. And they've got more chances now to be more competitive night in and night out. And they've got more balance on their club that, Mark, because we know the A's like to mix and match. They've got a good right-hand pitching lineup and a good left-hand pitching lineup. And we'll see how it goes. You know, I mean, look, you never know.
We'll see. You know, at the very least, just because of regression to the mean, I'm willing to state that they will have a better batting average this season than they did last season.
Well, you saw there was a statistic that came out. You know, the league batting average was, the league batting average was 240. How many teams had 240 last year? The number was 0. You know, it was like years ago, it was like 11 teams hit at least 240. Yeah. That number has come down, and hoping with the shift change and with the pitch clock where pitchers can't just take those extra few seconds to take deep breaths and reload to throw as hard as they can, that might be a factor that plays in favor of the offense. So hopefully it'll be a quick moving, exciting game. The A's have guys that can run, certainly starting with Ruiz if he makes the team. I think they've got a chance to do some things that they didn't have the opportunity to do before.
Yeah, I think it'll be more entertaining. I mean, I know a lot of those new Oakland guys, there's probably still a year off or so, but you know, by the end of this year, a lot of those guys could be there. Oh, it looks like we lost Hal. I don't know what happened to Hal, but I was going to ask, I mean, do you ever hear Hal when you're up there? I mean, you got to be hearing Hal when you're up there broadcasting, right?
I know where he's at. I see him doing work all the time, for sure.
Yeah, because you guys don't have any windows there, so you guys had a direct line to Hal, but all right. Well, thank you so much, Vince. Really, really appreciate it, man. That was great. Good luck this season, and I'll be seeing you at the ballpark in a few weeks here, man. So
sounds great, Alex. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it. To you, and thanks to Hal. I'll see you guys
soon. All
right,
I will. All right, thanks, Vince. Take care, man. See ya.
Adios.
At Amica Insurance, we know it's more than a life policy. It's about the promise and the responsibility that comes with being a new parent. Being there day and night, and building a plan for tomorrow, today. For the ones you'll always look out for, trust Amica Life Insurance. Amica, empathy is our best policy.